From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Dr. Babbling Pope.
Is this a compliment or some kind of insult?
No, it's referring to you as an infant. When you're learning language, because okay. That's what we're talking about today.
Because that's what we're talking
yes,
about.
Yes, yes.
So
language is very important. It's kind of a miracle that people learn it. It's so complex. There's grammar, there's prosody, there's all the vocabulary. So I was trying to remember my son, if he, his early language learning, and I kind of realized all I cared about was, did he say mom or dad first?
Because that's the competitor in you. And I'm telling you, my guess is you really wanted it to be dad.
That is correct. And yeah. And I don't remember what his first word was. So my guess is it was mom.
Right. Because if you remembered, it would be bragging rights for the rest of your life.
That's right.
Yeah.
So how about you?
So I remember a bunch of things. One thing I remember is that with my second kid, the first word was her older sister's name. So it wasn't mom or dad. It was Maymay because older sister is Megan.
Oh, that's heartwarming.
Oh, it was really sweet.
Yeah.
Right? That was the center of her universe, right? Of course, the older sibling did not feel that way, but that's what she felt. But I also remember we had this issue because with my middle daughter, she has a late birthday. She has an October birthday. And I really needed to get her into some form of daycare. Mm-hmm. And she most people don't take you, or at this particular place, you had to be two.
So you're just missing the cutoff.
We were just missing the cutoff. And she was an early talker. The people were like, what? How old is she? Oh, my gosh, she's speaking sentences. And so I thought, you know what? Let's just try this. Let's just take her to the daycare center and kind of sneak her in there. And they were like, well, you know, her birthday's not good. And they're looking at her. And she looked up at them and she said, hey, what do you have for snack? And they were like, and she's in. Because like a kid who can talk and enunciate like that, when you're with a bunch of two-year-olds who can't, they're like, uh-huh, we'll take her.
That's really good. For that language. So she got that from you?
I'm a talker.
Yeah. Maybe.
I think actually all my kids were big talkers, but there's this one other story that I have to tell you, which is I had to bring one of my kids with me to a meeting. And a professor here, Ray McDermott, I said, I'm so sorry. You know, I have to just bring the baby in and I didn't have daycare or whatever. And she'll be good. And I said, like, won't you? You'll be so good. You're going to be good for us. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. And he said to me, I see she's taught you how to talk. You know, like, I feel like who's doing the real teaching here, right?
Very good, Denise.
Yes, exactly. So we're really lucky to have one of the world's experts here with us. Anne Fernald is the Josephine Knotts Knowles Professor of Human Biology here at Stanford University. She directs the Language Learning Lab in the Department of Psychology and does something that's kind of different. She conducts experimental studies of language processing by infants and young children, so really good experimental, and also does observational studies of parent infant interaction in the field. And that's pretty unusual when you do both. So we are so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you. It is a pleasure to be here.
So here's a question for you, which is, why does talking to little kids even matter? What's the big deal about parents talking to their kids?
Right. So my kid, I expected him to learn language from TV.
Right. And can't you just turn on the TV? Can't they just learn through other people?
I had stuff to do. Let him watch TV.
Yeah.
Right. Well,
yeah.
I hope he's doing okay because that's not a wonderful source early.
He goes to a lot of movies now, but
yeah,
it's okay.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I mean, that TV is not doesn't care about you out there. It's indifferent to the viewer. And talking with a child involves adjusting to a very immature learner who's starting at zero, basically. Mm. And rapidly changing from month to month. So you're making your Your speech appropriate to what you know that child's interested in. You're following the gaze of the child and seeing what he's looking at or she's looking at, and talking, naming that, and not just naming it, but talking, what does it do? What color is it? And things like that. And then upping the ante as the child starts talking back and elicits. I mean, like you said, Denise, they're pulling. They're pulling. And if you're there and open to that and ready to feed them, you know, brain nutrition, language, then it's a wonderful duo. But it's interesting that it's not common at all in many cultures.
It's not common to talk to your kid to because they're a baby and they think that they don't understand?
Well, there are lots of reasons probably why. But a recent study came out in child development just a month ago about a forager population in Bolivia. And based on very detailed time allocation measures, every 5 seconds, people kept track of what was happening in this population. Wow. These were ethnographers, not psychologists.
That's years precise.
It
yeah, is.
Every
it
five
is.
Seconds.
It is exactly. And so they would code, you know, within that 5 seconds, what happened. And one of the things that happened that was of no interest to the original researchers was somebody talk to a child, right? So they weren't asking what was said. They just were saying, did it happen? And if it happened, it was entered into that log. The finding was that children from birth to 4 in this population hear less than 1 minute per daylight hour for 12 hours a day.
Of direct interaction.
Of direct interaction, that's right.
People are talking around them, but nobody is talking to them.
People are talking around them, and children are, well, I think this even included directed talk from other children. But ethnographers and sociolinguists who have done beautiful, insightful field work in sites like this, in populations like this, will explain that you know, they're learning by other – well, will surmise that they're learning by other ways. They're engaging with children. Another recent study done in a Yucatan Mayan population showed that by the age of 3, 90% of the speech that children heard was from other children. And so often the conclusion is, well, they're learning from other children. So this is a highly controversial set of questions that I'm struggling in.
So is it controversial because we don't trust the evidence, or it's controversial that, look, this level of interaction must be sufficient because this culture is still surviving?
Right. Okay. Yes.
The latter.
In a way, both. But the question is the fact that it is so different from the standard in industrialized countries. You've heard the term "weird societies" in capital letters. It stands for Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic.
Okay,
right?
I had not heard that before.
All right, that's very cool.
That's pretty cool.
It's a big complaint of university research is that it's done on weird populations.
On weird populations, yeah. And 98% of the research that's published is done on weird populations who represent 12% of humanity. And we are forever making claims based on kids at the big nursery school that children do this, right? And half a mile away, they might not. But that's not part of the theory, right? It's children do this and not what kinds of support do they have in their world that maybe other children do not, that enables that capacity to bloom.
But this is of concern because I'm anticipating you're going to say more verbal interaction with a child is better.
Right.
For upward mobility
exactly.
or satisfaction.
Well, that's where it gets controversial
right.
because are we judging, you know, and I often get accused of having a deficit perspective, a deficit
right. so
about this.
The idea that some other culture has a deficit compared
right.
to ours.
Well, this term also has a very ardent, heavy tradition. It came out of the 60s. When there was lots of, you know, America just discovered that there were millions of children in this country, African Americans among them, who were not getting schooling at all, much less good schooling, right? And so the discovery that there were differences in the family that could be contributing to their outcomes was viewed as good news, and there was a book written in 1963 called called something about the language deficit or whatever. The culturally deprived child. That's what it was called, culturally deprived. As if you don't go to if you don't go to concerts and museums, then you're all right. And so that term there was quite a toxic one. On the one hand, it is responsible for Head Start, because people said, hey, if this is in the family, it's in the world, if it's something we can change and teach and learn about, we can change it and we can help these kids. And then there was a huge backlash of people saying this is disrespectful and to, you know, it's a deficit just because they're not like you and so forth. So, I'm accused of representing that point of view.
So you're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we are speaking with Anne Fernald, who's the director of the Language Learning Lab in the Department of Psychology. And she studies infants and how they learn language. And I know there's been a phrase called the 30 million word gap, which is pretty staggering. So do you want to say a little bit?
So let me just So education always runs the risk of cultural imperialism.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes.
So and that's always going to be brackish water.
Right.
Because you sort of want some things, you don't want others. You want to respect the people you serve, but you also want to help them in ways that they may not know and so forth.
Absolutely.
So very complicated. Yeah. Let's set that aside for a moment. I'm a parent. I want to make sure that my child thrives.
Mm-hmm.
What is the 30 million word gap? That sounds like a lot of words I need to say.
Sounds like a lot of words.
Boy, it's back in front of the videotape for my kid.
Well,
no, Dan, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to put them in front of the TV.
Well, I don't know what 30 million words is. I'm assuming it's how many words I say.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. Yes. Or not.
Or not, but, as the case may be.
As the case may be, yeah. Okay. Well, this term came from a landmark study that was published in 1995 by two researchers in Kansas called Hart and Risley. They studied 42 families, and they had demographic diversity there with professor kids, as they called them, at the top, and then a low SES group of families that were on welfare, but only six of that sample. And then in between, a working class and a more middle class group. So they were going to record the speech, and tape recorders were new in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a heroic effort. There weren't computers; you were doing it on carbon paper, right, and typing it out, and et cetera. And so they followed these 42 kids, the kids in the families, from the age of I think 4 months up to the age of 3 years, and then extrapolated out to the fourth year. And transcribed all of that speech and looked at what was going on in these different families, all of whom loved their children. It was not a story about love.
Mm-hmm.
That was that they had in common.
Yeah.
And yet the language environment was very, very strikingly different. Now, you know, at the time, Noam Chomsky is saying that variability is irrelevant, right? That language is innate, that input doesn't matter at all.
You're going to learn it no matter what.
That's
right.
Right. And so linguistics wasn't the least bit interested in differences among children. That was a trivial, theoretically barren topic.
Wow.
And generations of graduate students were convinced of that, and we're just now coming out of it because you know, more, to my mind, enlightened and grounded theories of language development.
Just to defend Chomsky for
a moment. Yeah, go for it.
He didn't care about people. He cared about language.
Yeah.
He didn't care how people acquired language. He studied language,
right.
Not people.
Right. That's true.
Yeah.
And he also studied syntax. Syntax was the only mystery to be explained, right? And the thing is that you know, your little two-year-old, she's already got the, what are we having for snack? She's not saying, what snack having?
Yeah.
Or you know, dog, eat dog,
right,
instead of dog eat. She's got the word. She may only have 200 words to her name, but she's got the word order right.
And it's not like I taught her, this is a pronoun.
Yeah.
This is a part of speech.
Course.
This
okay.
is a noun. I mean, it happens miraculously.
Right. But there are aspects of syntax that you can probably pick up by overhearing, and sorting that out, and with very few vocabulary words, be a proficient little speaker at the age of three with an accent that's clearly an American accent if that's where you're learning it. And so you can declare that child as a competent speaker. And that was as far as Chomsky was interested in development. Now, you cannot get a job at the age of three with those, you know, 3,000 words that you've got
Allie
and the perfect accent.
She might have been able to. Maybe. She was that good.
Right. But that partly explains it. So his saying it's a trivial question, and then the backlash to the civil rights movement and the war on poverty and all of that, saying it's deeply disrespectful. In the 90s, then, wonderful people, including Shirley Bryce Heath, who's at Stanford, was at Stanford for many years, started saying, her book was called Ways with Words. There isn't just one way to talk. It's not just about the word order and the syntax. It's how you use language to tease and to brag and to tell stories and all of that. And that was the beginning of initially a very constructive focus on cultural differences, which had gotten lost or rather just swept under the rug. But they weren't interested in putting any kind of quantitative. It was purely qualitative work, right? So you've got Chomsky. It's a perfect storm because Chomsky is the cultural psychologists come along and say, you have no business looking at differences among children in poverty and affluence, and Bryce Heath comes along and says you have no business quantifying anything because let a thousand flowers bloom. How you learn language is your business in your culture, and variability was just not allowed. You didn't talk about social class differences. We Americans pretended they didn't have them.
And then the study comes out.
Yes, and then the study comes out. Right. It was started in the 70s and was not only up against technical limitations, but up against stiff headwinds coming from this is not interesting. And it was kind of suppressed for the first 10 years or so. I can remember when I saw it, and I think it must have been 2005 or so, cited by Paul Tough, who is a writer, very interested in education, for the New York Times Magazine, and thinking, wow, it's finally hit the mainstream. This is interesting. It's important to say about that book that if people read the book instead of just the sound bite, which is the 30 million word gap,
right,
they would find it deeply empathic and modest and humble in a way that many academic monographs aren't.
So just understand, the 30 million word gap was that it was people from more means and wealth spoke to their children 30 million more words than if you were working class or unemployed or
So,
but this was on an economic division.
This
line.
Is right. It was economic, and it was based on SES or socioeconomic status is often operationalized or quantified in terms of mothers and fathers' income and level of the profession, but there are other ways to do it. But yes, that is exactly what they did, is transcribed the speech. But they didn't just look at the syntax. In fact, that was kind of incidental. They looked at really fascinating things, like what did you use language to do? And they found, for example, that when you look at things like, don't do that, stop, watch out, right? Those kinds of directives that the high SES, the wealthier, more educated families, and the low SES families were pretty much equal in that because you've got to control kids' behavior.
Right.
Overall,
don't stick your finger in the light socket.
That's right.
Just stop
pulling the dog's, ear.
Right.
Right.
Boom. There's no oh, honey, it's okay.
You're right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting example, Denise.
Can you tell that's
this
from
is
experience?
Clearly touching close to the heart there, right? Yeah. Right. So they found that parents in all groups spend a certain amount of time keeping their child safe and not touching that hot stove or running out in the street and all of that. So it wasn't about, the wealthier families were never negative or whatever. They absolutely were. But there was the ratio of positive to negative was completely different because in the higher SES families, for every one of those prohibitions, there were five encouraging things, positive things that told the child, go ahead and do that, and compared to don't do that, stop doing that. And the ratio was pretty much reversed at the lower end of the SES spectrum. Mm. So it was about, it wasn't about syntax at all. Chomsky probably hated it. And because it was about the emotional warmth and accessibility, the engagement with the kid's interests, the respect for the child's growing curiosity, all of these things.
Well, this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with Anne Fernald. I'm very curious to know what the best thing to do then is as a parent.
I'm a low SES parent, and this report comes out, I'm pissed off.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, how would I not be pissed off told me that you basically told me I'm a bad parent.
Well, I think that is a perfect thing to talk about when we get back. Next up on SiriusXM Insight 121.
We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. Today we are talking with Anne Fernald, and she is professor of human biology here at Stanford and director of the Language Learning Lab in the Department of Psychology. And we ended with a very controversial...
So let me roll it up a little bit. So where we end is that different communities, whether defined by culture, economic status, parents' education, work with their kids greater and lesser degrees to help develop their language. And so the question is, does this matter?
Right.
Like my kid watch TV? And am I waiting for the bad thing to happen? Ignore the TV example. Does it matter? Does the parent interaction with the children really make a difference down the line?
Important to note that TV is a fact of life these days, and
Thank
that
you.
There is good TV, and can help make good selections, then you do not feel guilty for your whole life.
Avengers, 24 hours a day.
I don't think she's talking about that.
No. Okay. So the question is, why does it matter, right? The massive difference, the Parton-Risley thing, was over 4 years. There are 30 million more words that advantage children here than poor children know. By the way, those numbers have been greatly reduced by a different study that they recorded for 1 hour a day, which was very, very dense in speech to the child. If you record all day long and average over those times when not much is going on, it turns out that it's only a 4 million word gap by the end of 4 years. So that maybe is that's a little easier to deal with. But still, that even though the numbers were changed and reduced, the differences are there. And Parton-Risley then followed these children up to the third grade and found that those kids who had heard so much more language and had heard more positive language, they were interested in the emotional quality of it, not just the sheer number of words, were doing better in school. Now, of course, those kids also get better, you know, their mothers use dental floss. Maybe it was the dental floss, right? It's confounded with better health care, better
race, ethnicity, income, floss.
Right.
Now you know what to do.
So there are so many other contributions that it could be, you know, because wealthier families live a very different lifestyle in ways that may support children's learning on different levels. But now study after study after study has followed up on this. And in our own work, we use language processing measures, asking how quickly does the child turn to a picture when they hear it named. And within milliseconds, the child children are turning within less than a second. And how fast they are turns out to be a measure that's highly correlated with their vocabulary growth. So we're tapping into some brain process that's facilitated by talk to children. So we find out that those kids who are faster are also those who are hearing more language at home. So something's going on there. And I've been thinking a lot about what that mechanism is. So let me try to explain that babies can only learn to understand and speak language through interactions with caregivers and others at home for the first 4 or 5 years of life. The school is not involved. And yet, the size of their vocabulary, when they show up at school at 4 or 5 and they're tested at that age, they haven't set foot in school yet at all, the size of their vocabulary is one of the strongest predictors of how successful they will be in reading comprehension 4 years later when they get to the fourth grade. Okay?
A lot of parents out there are going to say now, wait a minute, that sounds really important.
Yeah.
What can I do to ensure this?
Yeah, well, you can spend those first few years with your child building that foundation, because you are the source of that. You can only learn words that you are hearing from other people. And by the way, you know, in our studies and others, we look at the effect of overheard speech. Maybe just hearing lots of language going on is helpful.
Right. Can I just take them to a busy marketplace?
Yes, exactly. You're going to find great vegetables, but you're not going to be correlated with vocabulary.
So it really has to be from the caregiver.
Yeah. And there are studies showing that, too. Others that look at kids' speech, they say, well, look, he's on the playground all the time. He's hearing all the stimulating speech from other children. Problem is, other children aren't taking that child's perspective, aren't using the words they know he knows, aren't following his interest. They're on their own trajectory, right? So kid speech from other kids is also not related to vocabulary growth.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope, and we're speaking with Anne Fernald, who's a professor of human bio here at Stanford University and directs the Language Learning Lab in the Department of Psychology.
So I'm a parent. Should I be using grammatically complex sentences, big words, or is it really just interact and respond to the child and lead them?
Okay. Good question there. The Hart and Risley 30 million word thing is often cited in a very shallow way, as if it's just dog, dog, dog 30,000 times. That won't help, right? You want to point out what the dog looks like and that it's got a fuzzy tail and that it eats, you know, drinks water and chases balls. You want it. It's not just about repetitious naming. Now, when a baby's 18 months old, naming things, learning the names of things, that's the big challenge. That's a huge accomplishment. By 24 months, this child is engaged in the miraculous mental time travel that language is, right? That no other species. I looked at our dog this morning as I left, and I said, I'll be back at 2, right? And she has – there's no way in the world I can evoke the past and relate it to the future for that dog. It's just going to be, do I show up with a ball in my hand, and that's the trigger, okay? So this mental time travel, you've got to exercise that. You've got to talk about the past and the future and link them, right? Because there you're not just talking about something, the apple in front of you. You're talking about the apple that we got at Grandma's last week. We picked on the tree. You're teaching the kid about trees and how apples grow. We're going to take those tomorrow and go back to Grandma's house, and she's going to bake apple pie, and won't that taste good? So that is what we call a quality dimension of speech. And Hart and Risley pointed out that quantity, high quantity, is correlated with quality. If you just repeat, you know, simple sentences or don't a million times, you have high quantity but not quality. But what you want to do is be, as the child grows older and is able to understand more, yes, upping the ante, not fantastically
complex. So 24 months is when sort of grammar is showing up, the ability to do past tense, future tense.
You have to have two words to, you know, rub together to get grammar, right, if you're talking about word order. So, yeah. So they are beginning to do that. But even using words like I believe, I think he's coming, but maybe he's not. I mean, there you're using mental state talk, which is important in children's developing what they call theory of mind, their ability to understand that other people have different perspectives and that their perspectives will guide their behavior.
This sounds like a lot of work, but it also sounds kind of empowering. Like I have something in me that can really help my kid and help her or him in the future in terms of reading comprehension and learning. So a part of me is a little bit scared, like how am I going to know what to say? But it sounds like if you have the right tone and you really try to kind of tell stories in your car on the way to preschool, and it doesn't have to be sit down and have a lesson. This is just through natural interaction.
And reading books. And telling stories. You know, I was reading to my grandchild the old stories by Brer Rabbit, which are American sort of folk tales. And it's always about a trickster, right? Or let me take Red Riding Hood, where the wolf says, I'm going to go hide in the bed and pretend I'm grandma, and she's going to come and I'm going to eat her, right? Well, that involves theory of mind. That involves you. The plot is she's going to think something that's incorrect and go too close. So using language through storytelling, you don't need fancy books. You can do it that way.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. I feel like we've learned so much today. And Dan, don't worry, your child's not completely you know, doomed because of the TV watching.
But okay. He just uses texting. He doesn't need grammar.
There you go. There you go. Thank you, everyone, for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you've missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app or on SoundCloud.